The biggest kick of Sadio Mane's life.
And Mane scores! For the first time ever, Senegal are the kings of their continent.
Hello and welcome to the Sound of Football podcast. I am Graham Sibley, and as ever, I'm joined by Terry DeFellon.
Hello.
No Jan this week, but hey, Terry and I will struggle on, won't we?
We'll try and find some more speaking for Jan.
To fill the spaces that he would normally be filling.
I'm confident that I can speak for two people.
I'm sure you can, actually. I think listeners are going to be sagely nodding along, saying Terry can talk for quite a few people, I think.
I'm the Niklas Zula of podcasting. There's literally two of me.
Now, there's a contemporary reference, because he just signed for Dortmund today, didn't he?
I know. That is quite a coup in view of the fact that Dortmund got absolutely shellacked yesterday. And then they thought, well, you know, why don't we announce the Sula signing now, and then that way people might stop yelling at us.
Yeah, it's nice to know that there's still some activity after the transfer window is closed.
To be fair, it's a pre-contract, obviously, so he doesn't join until the summertime. But yeah, I am surprised. My thinking is, why are you leaving Bayern Munich? You must be looking for a new challenge. I don't think Bayern wanted him to go. He's just decided to leave. His contract's up. And I thought, well, he's going to go to England for the challenge of the Premier League, the opportunity to be paid, you know, even more money than he's currently being paid, and the chance to talk to Jeff Shreves and stuff like that. I mean, who wouldn't want to do that? But in fact, he's gone to Borussia Dortmund instead, and apparently they have thrown a huge amount of money at him. But again, as I said, he's big enough to be actually legally two people in some states in Germany. So, you know, that's probably fair enough. I mean, he obviously isn't two people, but you know, that would be crazy. I mean, think of his tax bill.
Well, but yes.
It is, in all seriousness, it's a tremendously good signing for Dortmund, because, you know, to sign a player, you know, an experienced player in his mid-20s, top-class German international centre-back, is not something that Dortmund usually do. They usually prefer to sign callow 19-year-olds and then turn them into colossuses and then flog them on for £100 million.
Well, they'll certainly do well to have a new centre-back there, won't they? Because, as you say, they got absolutely humped, didn't they, at home at the weekend?
They did.
But it was a weekend of amazing results, wasn't it? Every week we curate a list of seven games for you to watch from Friday to Sunday. But I think I probably watched a bit of at least eight or nine games yesterday. I was hopping around like nobody's business, trying to get as much action as I could find. And even at the end of the Africa Cup of Nations final that was late on, I still thought, there must be something out there for me to watch. It's got to be. Does this look like a man who'd had all he could eat? Because there's been FA Cup action, there's been league action from across Europe, there's been the aforementioned Africa Cup of Nations. And behind it all, not actually on our screens yet, but there's been the Club World Cup as well. There's just been all the football, isn't there?
There is all the football. And yesterday was just a cavalcade of football. I switched on the television at 2:30 and I didn't stop watching the football until the AFCON final had finished, which was gone 10 o'clock. And it was football all the way. I watched the Dortmund game. I watched a bit of Barca versus Atleti. I watched the Betis game on La Liga TV by accident. I was supposed to be watching one of the cup games, but I forgot and ended up just carrying on watching that game. And then, of course, AFCON, which was an absolute triumph.
Of course, we were all expecting it to be 0-0, weren't we? None of us were surprised that it went to penalties. Egypt's third penalty shootout after a 0-0 draw in the competition. But fantastic nonetheless.
In the preview, I managed to successfully predict that this would be the final, although it's not that much of a stretch, obviously, but I was able to successfully predict that. But I did say in my preview that the longer the game went on without Senegal taking the lead, the more likely it was that, in fact, Egypt would just win on penalties. I placed a cheeky little bet on the game not finishing at full time, that it would be a draw at full time. But I was expecting Egypt to then go ahead and win, and I was convinced that they would win on penalties. Such is the magic and the thrall that they hold their opposition in. But you have to give it to Senegal for having the balls. You know, this is their third straight final, and obviously the previous two that they have lost because it was their first victory. And to be able to go up and have the balls to take those penalties was extraordinary, and to put them away. And Sadio Mane, after having missed a penalty in the third minute, to then have to go and take the decisive one in the shootout and nail it. Well, I have to say I was out of my seat. It was extraordinarily exciting. The Efodokoku said, this has been a game for the purists, which is often a diplomatic way of saying it's been a rubbish game. But it wasn't a rubbish game. I mean, it was super, super tense. But there was enough opportunities to make it interesting. It wasn't one of these where the two teams cancelled each other out. Both teams did their best. Senegal, a little bit more open, a little bit more attacking, unsurprisingly, because they've got the players, they're the favourites. Egypt have had injury problems, and so consequently they have been playing guys out of position. They've got a keeper who's like second choice and was carrying a groin injury. Understandably, a lot more conservative, a lot more compact, but no less deserving of winning if they had done. Two different ways of playing football, but both producing a really tense, really interesting, exciting game of football. And I'm delighted for Senegal, I have to say, and I'm delighted for the Senegalese people as well.
Yeah, absolutely fantastic. And yeah, Egypt have won it enough times.
They'll be back next year and probably win it, because it's at the Ivory Coast, and everyone knows Ivory Coast aren't going to win it.
And it was good job that old Ball FIFA guy was there at the presentation as well, just in case the guy from CAF didn't know how to hand a cup over. Very good to see him getting involved in CAF, isn't it? And just keeping them on side.
Absolutely. I mean, and there's nothing, and I just think it's worth, because, you know, everyone knows that we have warm and fuzzy feelings about Bald FIFA guy on this podcast, and would never suggest anything disparaging about him or his character whatsoever. And I'm certain, you know, and any suggestion that his visit there was opportunistic, it's appallingly cynical, and I fundamentally disagree with it. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with an old white man telling a black man how to hold a trophy properly. I mean, there's nothing sinister or wrong in that kind of thing. I mean, you're just reading into it, you know. I mean, you're projecting your own anxieties onto that.
Maybe. Maybe that he was only there because it's the only way he could get a flight from Qatar to the UAE. I mean, maybe that's the only reason he was actually there. Because obviously he's got to be there for the Club World Cup, which is happening in Abu Dhabi, I think, at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. It is totally happening in Abu Dhabi at the moment. Yeah, because Al Ahly are the African club representing. They're an Egyptian club, and a good number of their players were playing in that final for Egypt. And they managed to beat Monterrey of Liga MX in their quarterfinal, somewhat against the odds, because they were fielding a weakened side, and they won that game. And will play Palmeiras in the semi-final.
They will indeed, yeah.
And you've got all of these Egyptian players who are all hot-footing it over to UAE to join the squad. I'm actually quite interested in watching that game. So I just want to see how Al Ahly play against Palmeiras. That's going to be a good one.
Yeah, well, Chelsea have got Al Hilal on the following night, haven't they, in the other semi-final.
And about which I know considerably less, of course.
Yeah, well, they are the Asian champions, aren't they?
They are. So they're not rubbish. I mean, obviously, people talk about the Club World Cup, but I mean, it's dangerous to suggest that the teams that go there are rubbish. But obviously, you expect the European and South American teams with the much, much higher, you know, wage bill, you know, and to have the better quality players. But then I think people would have said the same thing about Monterrey, and that's what happened there. So,
well, indeed. So, well, we'll all see what happens there at the weekend.
Because we'll all be watching.
We'll all be watching that. Well, actually, if you're in the UK, the final is going to be on Saturday afternoon, and it's going to be embargo busting as well.
Ah, fantastic! Well, because it's a FIFA tournament, I suppose, isn't it?
Yeah.
So it trumps everything else.
Trumps everything.
Probably be free on the FIFA YouTube channel too, because unless some broadcaster picks it up in your market, listeners, then you could just go to FIFA TV on YouTube and it'll probably be there live.
Yeah, Channel 4 free. In the UK, and it will be
on Channel 4.
It'll be on Channel 4, 4:30 kickoff on Saturday afternoon.
Yeah, of course. I think I'm totally going to be watching.
Well, I mean, the embargo is a bit of a movable feast now, isn't it? I mean, we came out of the clubhouse at Whiteleaf on Saturday while the West Ham game was still going, didn't we?
Yes, that's very true.
The extra time was still on the screen and we were going off to watch the game while there was still football on the telly.
Because normally, under normal circumstances, that game would have gone to a replay by that point.
Yes,
it would have ended. So the embargo slowly being eroded away, because it's interesting because the UEFA embargo for the Champions League is kind of defied by Sky, because Sky put championship games up against against BT's coverage of the Champions League. Now, obviously, the championship is a second tier, so therefore doesn't probably sort of like count in the embargo, because I think it only applies to the first tier. The championship is one of the strongest and best leagues in Europe, so it is kind of a bit cheeky, but, you know, there you go. They're cheeky chaps.
That's fair. It's all political machinations, isn't it, Terry?
Wheels within wheels, Graham.
Maneuverings, isn't it? All of this. Mm-hmm. You could say this about the Club World Cup. This is going to be the last time it's this seven-team format. And this has been one of Ball FIFA Guy's biggest things, isn't it? To try and beef up the Club World Cup. And the next one is meant to be in China. We still don't know when it's going to be. It's probably going to be next year now. But that's going to have 24 teams in it, including a proposed 8 teams from Europe. And this is one of his things. This is one of his things, along with biennial World Cups, that of FIFA trying to muscle in on international club football and TV deals and all of the money coming into FIFA instead of schlopping around going to UEFA of all places.
Yeah. One doesn't want to feel sorry for the European and South American confederations at all. But FIFA make quite a lot of money out of the World Cup. And usually in the past, the narrative has been is that UEFA tend to look at the World Cup and the club game looks at the international game of the World Cup and seethes slightly because it says, oh, look at all that money that they're making. We could be making all that money. Because, you know, it's the one event where the doors are flown open and everybody, even people who have no interest whatsoever in football, even people who actively dislike football will watch the World Cup if their nation is doing well in it. So it's just worth that much more money. But it seems that Ball FIFA Guy has decided, as you say, he wants to cash in. He wants to go aggressive against the club games. And it's having a knock-on effect also in international football as well.
Yeah, well, especially with the fact that this whole thing about the upcoming expiry of the current international fixture calendar, which goes up to 2024. So it's all a bit up in the air as to what's going to happen after that. Things like the Nation League, expansion of Nations League as well, and about who is able to manoeuvre themselves into what position and give themselves enough leverage with those big money sponsors and TV deals. Well, now, one of the most interesting manoeuvres that will happen this year is that London sees a showpiece final, doesn't it, Terry, at the beginning of June. We have the Finalissima, which is a return of an idea that's come and gone in the past, isn't it? I think they tried it once in the 80s and the 90s. And essentially, it's the winner of the Copa America against the winner of the Euros. So Italy versus Argentina at Wembley. All fun and larks, yes?
Perfectly crominant idea. Like everything else in football, it's rampaciously commercial. If I can use the word rampaciously. But nevertheless, it has sporting merit. Of course it does. I mean, the champions of Europe versus the champions of America. I mean, I would watch that game, and I will watch that game. If I can get along to Wembley, I would love to go and see it live. I'm almost certain as well that the players will be up for it. This seems like the kind of caper that the Italian players would just definitely want to do. They would not want to lose this game. And the Argentines will definitely want to do it because they love the opportunity to get one over European sides. Like a lot, you know, historically, CONMEBOL teams, they place more value on the Club World Cup, for example, and the Intercontinental Cup before it was the Club World Cup. They see that as the opportunity for them to stake their claim as the best in the world. And so I think it will be taken seriously. And I would imagine that there's a significant cash purse as well that goes along with it too, which is that isn't a motivation enough. So yes, I am very much in favour of that, although it may well be that it might be used as something of a staging post, shall we say, for other activities and other events and tournaments that might follow, you know, in the wake of it.
Yes, of a nice friendly agreement between UEFA and CONMEBOL, because the two organisations haven't chosen London out of thin air, because London is due to be the site of their combined office. They are setting up a place for administration and, well, basically somewhere to channel all their money, I suppose. What do you make of this whole them sort of setting up home together in London? And what direction is it going? Are we going to see South American teams in the Nations League?
Well, there's already talk about that, hasn't there? That was something that was reported towards the end of, and in fact, if I'm not mistaken, we included it in our advent.
We did indeed, yes,
back
indeed.
End of last year, because we would heard these reports. It's not official, that, but it's being strongly reported. On the one hand, you think, well, why not have an office where CONMEBOL and UEFA can explore their mutual interests and do so in this manner? It makes complete sense. Why not have it in London as well? Because, you know, London is rapidly, Britain is obviously now positioning itself as some kind of offshore location separate from the EU, where, you know, you can come along and participate in all manner of fun, unregulated activities. So it's straight up the Brexit street. And yeah, I mean, it gives them an opportunity at the centre of a big market like the UK to be able to explore different things that they can do. And one of those things might well be the idea of CONMEBOL nations joining League A in the Nations League. Again, I think I said at the time that while, again, it would be rampagiously commercial and so the sort of thing that you'd be against, but sadly, it wouldn't stop me from watching it. I would totally watch CONMEBOL teams playing UEFA teams because I just love watching that kind of thing. And it makes me wonder where does the World Cup fit in on all of this? What does bald FIFA guy think about all of this?
Well, there is that, isn't there? Because as well, today we had news, even more news, and it just keeps on flying in through the doors at the moment. But we had news that the home nations in here in the UK, so the five home nations of the UK and Ireland, getting together, which we did kind of know anyway, that they were going to get together to put a bid in for the World Cup. And last month, there was rumours that they were looking to ditch the World Cup bid in favour of a joint Euro 2028 bid, a possible 32-team tournament Euro 2028 bid. And that was confirmed today with all of the FAs coming out with statements about, yes, this is what we're going for. We don't want a World Cup anyway because, you know, not saying it in as many words, but say, well, why do we want to throw money at FIFA when it's all corrupt and we're never going to get a World Cup anyway? Do you think that they have at least a 50-50 chance of getting the Euros, or as opposed to like a snowball in hell's chance of getting the World Cup? That's what I thought when I saw it.
I certainly can't see the UK winning anything at the moment like that in terms of the World Cup. I can't see them winning that because there's still not been enough water being passed under the bridge since the last time that they bid for the World Cup. And I just can't see them even try. I was surprised that they even tried for it. I mean, I appreciate, obviously, the last time it was England on its own. But I still feel that the UK in general doesn't enjoy a great deal of standing in terms of international relations in a lot of parts of the country, of the world, rather. Ireland, obviously, is a different country and enjoys a different standing. But of course, would be partners in this deal. And my worry is that, you know, that the UK would just stink the place out when it comes to bidding for these kind of things. Moreover, my suspicion is that the host of what is going to be the Centenary World Cup may well actually already be kind of decided or on its way to being decided. I don't know. Maybe that sort of thing just doesn't happen at FIFA anymore. I don't know. But I wouldn't be at all surprised if the World Cup was hosted in a Middle Eastern country for that tournament. I would love it to be in South America with the final in the Centenario in Montevideo. But, I mean, that's just fantasy. That's romanticism on my part. That's not going to happen. So I feel, yes, that they are on safer ground with UEFA. I think they have allies, plenty of allies with UEFA. And if it transpires, indeed, that their UEFA CONMEBOL office, if that takes traction, and if we're able, I say we, Britain, are able to facilitate lucrative, competitive, extremely popular competitions between top UEFA and top CONMEBOL nations, then I think that UEFA as a broader community will be quite well disposed towards the United Kingdom in their bid for Euro 2028.
Because this has been not a declaration of war or anything as dramatic as that, but it is certainly the home nations siding with UEFA rather than FIFA and saying, no, this is where we're going to put our eggs. This is the basket we're going to use here.
And rightly so. I mean, why wouldn't you? I don't really hold with this sort of thing, but the reality of the situation is this. You're going to get nothing from FIFA. FIFA delegates lied in the face of the future King of England. It's a massive slap in the face. Why on earth would high-ranking politicians and public figures want to be involved in any attempt to persuade FIFA to do anything apart from submit to justice? I'm not in any way portraying us, the UK, as being in any way nice. We are not nice people. That doesn't mean that we should just simply hang out with villains, and particularly if they've got no interest in us. FIFA have burned their bridges when it comes to the UK, and I doubt very much they care about that. So yes, it makes complete sense to shack up with UEFA in this instance. The whole business with the European Super League has perhaps helped to cement that relationship further as well.
I'm really not sure where it leaves FIFA now. If you've got CONMEBOL and UEFA basically setting up house together, the only two confederations that have ever won the World Cup, in many ways, you could probably look at that and say, well, this is just them trying to maintain the old order, not liking the fact that football has globalised even after they've worked so hard to do that. Basically, for them to still keep control of the game. Would that be a fair criticism, or is that basically saying, well, look, everyone's out for what they can get here. FIFA are out more than anyone else. So it's no surprise that everyone's going to start acting like this.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably premature to suggest that there's some kind of game plan here. But I mean, it is obviously about power play, and it's about controlling the money. What's being set up here is the possibility of UEFA and CONMEBOL setting themselves as a buttress against FIFA. In the first instance, to defend themselves against the biennial World Cup and further what they were considered to be incursions into their turf. I mean, the biennial World Cup was a huge, that is, tanks on the lawn, that is, you know, we are going to put a World Cup right smack bang in the middle of your Confederate Championships, whether you like it or not. You're only going to react negatively to that. And of course, they would think, well, why don't we just join forces and see what we can come up between us? I can envisage in years to come, if this goes badly for FIFA, that the Nations League format, which has proved to be extremely popular and quite practical as well, may actually effectively replace the World Cup, because you still got that summer tournament thing going on with the Nations League, although it's only a Final Four at the moment. But you could see if UEFA and CONMEBOL started playing in the Nations League in their own Nations League together, with a slightly perhaps expanded tournament, you know, in the corresponding summer, that I think would generate tremendous interest. And then if you were to invite African teams and Asian teams to come and join in as well, and if you could promise equity for the African teams so they came in as equal partners on this, then you're actually resolving an awful lot of problems that FIFA have never been able to resolve. I mean, BFG really badly wants Africa on side, but he can't give them what they want, and that's more World Cup slots.
Yeah.
Whereas if you were to start the World Cup from scratch, you might think about doing it about it in a slightly different way. I mean, we'd all miss the summer tournaments and wouldn't want that taken away. But you would have the opportunity of being able to say, well, look, let's have it a little bit more equitable and with maybe a smaller tournament going on in the summertime, but like lots of games or games going on through the international calendar. And that would resolve an awful lot of problems as well, I think, and would really get up FIFA's nose.
You look at the World Cup, and the only solution that FIFA have at the moment of allowing Africa or Asia more slots is by expanding it, by making it bigger, by putting up to 48 teams, which of course starts to get a bit big. It's a bit too huge, isn't it, for a tournament? So there isn't an easy way of getting around that, because you do need to give UEFA a lot of slots to satisfy your hunger for lucrative TV deals and your hunger for sponsorship. You do need the big European sides in there. And to guarantee that you're going to get Italy, Spain, France and England all in there, you really have to make sure that you've got at least a dozen slots, because if you shrink it down any more than that, you're going to lose one or two of them. It's just the nature of the qualification process, isn't it, really? Unless you really fix it so that they don't get knocked out.
There's absolutely no getting around that. But if you look at the playoffs for the African nations, there's Egypt, Senegal, Cameroon, Algeria, Ghana, Nigeria, DR Congo, Morocco, Mali and Tunisia. And And in my relatively brief experience in watching African football over the last, certainly in the last few weeks, you would possibly think that all of those teams, I know Algeria had a terrible time of it, but they were the existing champions. All of those teams probably would feel that they would grace a World Cup. They do well in a World Cup. You might look at Ghana and you might look at DR Congo and think differently, but that is 10 very, very high quality football teams there. And actually only half of them are going through.
Yeah.
And that's wrong. Now, if you could come up with a formula that was more equitable, it means that it wouldn't look, the World Cup as well, this new system would look different. It would look different. But if you were offering the African teams a bigger piece of the pie, you get them on board. And ultimately, Graham, well, FIFA guy's not going to be able to achieve what he wants to achieve unless he can square this off. He's going to have to work out a way of expanding the number of African teams going in there. And as you say, the only way that you can give out now is by taking away from CONMEBOL, which I think is impossible, and from UEFA, which is almost impossible.
There seems to be a lot of ideas on the table and a lot of new plans going around. But really, all you can see, it just comes back to the same thing of saying, well, actually, status quo is going to win out here. They're not going to go to 48 teams. They're not going to go to 4 or 5 host World Cups. Where are they going to go? So are they going to stick with 32-team tournaments? All right, we've got, 3 hosts for the next World Cup, Canada, USA, and Mexico. They're not going to do what UEFA did for the Euros and say, well, okay, you can be a host, but there's no guarantee that you're going to actually be here. You've got to go through qualification. And I think this is probably what the problem is with the 5 home nation bid that we're seeing now, is whether or not all 5 nations will get immediate in on that tournament, or whether or not they'll have to go through qualification as well. But that's probably why they're going to push to put it up to 32 teams, I guess.
For the Euros, yeah, I think that that's got to be the better solution. Euro 2020 was a different one because it was a pan-European competition, and so therefore with so many hosts, the initial intention was that there wasn't a host nation, and so therefore everybody had to qualify. Whereas with Euro 2028, there will be a host nation. It's just there's going to be 5 of them, and which is going to make things a little bit unwieldy. The other thing, of course, that it speaks to is the quality of football in the world now just keeps getting better.
Yeah.
The next World Cup's going to be, as you say, Graham, in North America. And when that was announced, those of us who don't follow Canadian football that closely, and let's face it, that's probably most of us, to be fair, probably would have thought, well, the US are decent. Mexico, we know, are decent. Canada will struggle a bit. But we've found out actually quite recently that this is not the case, that Canada have clearly done a great deal of work, probably redoubled their efforts now that they've got the World Cup coming. They will be, you know, worthy hosts of that competition. A country that up to very recently didn't really play football. And so we're seeing the game expanding into areas of the world now. And we're now seeing the standard being raised that the World Cup in itself is not going to be what it says it is, because there'll be plenty of good teams that just won't be able to get in. And that's just going to be a continual problem. And I wonder whether or not there is a feeling amongst people that the World Cup is not actually sustainable and needs to be changed. And that perhaps the best way of doing that is by coming up with a rival formula that works. And that's why I keep coming back to the idea of why the Nations League is the genesis of that formula. I still don't know what it would look like.
Yeah.
But I can't help but thinking, because it is a decent format, and I can't help but wondering whether or not that's the formula for a future World Cup.
You said earlier about how if you were creating a World Cup from scratch, how would you do it? Would you do it in the same way that it's been done for pretty much 100 years? Back when teams got on a boat to go around to the other side of the world. We live in a time where international travel is easier, all right, pandemics notwithstanding, but it is easier to get a team across the world. It is easier to play a tournament and then most of your teams fly out to the Middle East to take part in a club international tournament, as we're seeing right now. So although whenever we start talking about changing of formats and everything, people do get worried and they do think, well, look, the World Cup is brilliant. It's the greatest show on earth. Why change it? This is the reason why people get so upset when people start saying, well, let's have it every 2 years. let's expand it, let's take it to parts of the world that don't really play football. And none of this is all bad ideas. They're just different ideas. And of course, there's no guarantee that it's going to be something that you're going to want to watch, which I think is what worries most people, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's like The Mandalorian and Book of Boba Fett, is it really? I don't know if it's Star Wars, but I like watching it. But other people don't like watching it. And stuff changes. And, you know, you have to sometimes leave it behind. I've got a feeling that it'll just come out in the wash, and that probably the World Cup will stay at 4 years, and maybe there'll be a new settlement of some description. But I can't help but feel that there is going to be some kind of reckoning. There needs to be some kind of change. I mean, you talked about international travel, and you're quite right. In many ways, it is easier. And it is very easy for teams to travel around the world, you know, yeah, pandemics notwithstanding. But it's going to become much, much harder for fans and supporters to travel around the world because of climate change, because a climate emergency is going to bring the cost of travel up significantly. And it might well be that, you know, these big festivals of football that are happening in single places, you know, become much harder to organise because you don't get that many people who are able to go there. And also, if they're becoming such unwieldy tournaments and you've only got a certain number of countries that can host them, that you have to have host countries as well, it all just becomes that much more problematic. And we said pandemics notwithstanding, but we have no guarantee that coronavirus won't throw up another disease, COVID-23, 25, 28, what have you, which throws us back into another pandemic and means we're back to square one. We have to think about that. And what that means, we might have to look at these big, not just the World Cup, things like the Olympic Games and stuff, and think going forward, you know, are we really in a position to hold these kind of events right now? Do we need to kind of scale back on that and maybe think about a more regionalized solution culminating in a final tournament at a central location, but on a smaller scale in order to accommodate pandemics, climate change and just, you know, and all of that stuff. And it might well be that a longer-term format might work out better for that. So it's all terribly interesting stuff.
And I guess most of this is political manoeuvrings as well. The statements that were coming around earlier today from the home nation FAs, I know one of them had a very sort of telling line in there about the confidence they have of going for a Euro bid because, effectively, it was a safe bet and UEFA are on their uppers and they need all the money they can get. And whereas you might think, well, you should be a bit more guarded about things like that, because like that's the way that sort of puts people off bits. But actually, it's refreshing honesty saying, well, yeah, we're in a great place. We provide lots of money. So we're in a great position to actually put it together. And I think that's what you're getting from everyone involved at the moment. You're getting everyone saying, well, we can do this. Because at the moment, I think with the pandemic and with things like, well, we've already seen the European Super League, which, although, you know, lasted only 48 hours, but, I mean, it's not going away ever, is it? It's always going to be there. And the fact that it was strangled at birth this time, the people who were involved in that, they'll have learned. And they'll know exactly who to look out for next time. All of these events, that whenever they come out, all of the reaction is always constantly monitored. When FIFA went big on the biennial World Cup statements, every time they're getting more and more people to say what a great idea it is. They're trying to dominate the conversation, aren't they? But I think at the end of the day, it's really just trying to give themselves cards to when they all sit around a table and start talking out, because whether or not people have got the balls to actually go ahead with any of this biennial World Cups or anything like that, because can you imagine a 48-team biennial World Cup? I can't see how you'd do that. You'd soon run out of hosts, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing that crosses my mind, is that where do you get the hosts for such a thing?
Yeah.
To begin with? I mean, and the huge amounts of money and the massive riders that FIFA insist upon when they do it. Even if I think they get this through, I don't think it will happen. But even if it was to go through, how many hosts, unless, of course, Infantino has got some kind of fantasy about carving out like the Middle East as some kind of permanent sort of like World Cup village,
which is what we said FIFA Island, didn't we? We've said it before. It's the concept. The Emirates will do that. They'll say, "Do you want us to build you an island? We'll do that. We'll have Football Island here, and this will be your home for the World Cup forever now."
In many respects, and this will hit us at home when we watch the World Cup, and we'll see a glimpse of a possible future. Qatar, it is going to be more like the Olympics, you know, in that not happening across an entire country per se. It's more like it's happening in a city. And, you know, if it hadn't have been for the pandemic, and it weren't for the fact that Qatar is quite a difficult place to be in, I think, for a lot of people, that it might have been an interesting vibe that had been going on there in that time. And I think that for a lot of people, they would look at that and say, well, this is probably how the World Cup should be, and that this is the future of it, especially if it's going to be biennial. We'll need basically big football metropolises, mega cities, that will be able to host these tournaments on that basis. And then actually just gets handed around a handful of countries, plus a few that can chip in from time to time. You know, the United States, perhaps Germany, and maybe even the United Kingdom. There's an awful lot of people who are going to lose out with that kind of idea. And I think that it will be resisted. But if Qatar is a success, you know, that is extra momentum and emboldens bald FIFA guy. It emboldens him to push further with his agenda.
Well, Qatar's a success with bald FIFA guy because he lives there now, doesn't he?
He totally lives there. Yeah, he loves it there.
Yeah, I think that's all we really need to know, isn't it, really? This is the choice that he's made, and this is the direction that he's going. So that's where FIFA's going too. Interesting times ahead, anyway. But absolutely. Hey, it'd be great to see where Comnable and UEFA open up their London office, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and it'd be interesting to see if they got their jobs going as well.
Well, as I said earlier, the embargo-busting final of the FIFA Club World Cup 2021 is on Saturday, and we'll be covering it in the box set with perhaps a few references to this discussion. It's probably going to be a much quieter weekend, I think. It can't be as crazy as it was last week. We won't be able to start off the weekend with another Man United Borough again, will we?
That must have been a very humbling experience for Manchester United.
As well as other teams, as well, Bournemouth as well. Bournemouth going out to Boreham Wood. Oh dear, that's got a sting, hasn't it?
Yes, you know, once upon a time that wouldn't have been that much of a shock, but Bournemouth being, you know, on the cusp of being back in the Premier League, that's a big deal.
Well, magic of the cup, isn't it, really? That's what it's all about.
It is the magic of the cup, yeah. Unless you're at Crystal Palace, where we put Hartlepool to the sword, washed away the stain of 1993.
And got another home tie in the next round as well.
To Stoke. Yeah. I mean, it's opened up quite nicely for us, actually. That's a tough, of course it's tough because they're a championship side. But, you know, you've got to be happy with a home draw anyway. And against a championship side, we've got to fancy our chances. Who knows? Maybe our name is on the cup, Wham.
Maybe. Well, it's league action this week, unless you're north of the border, because there is a Scottish FA Cup fifth round this weekend as well. But if you want to see what we select to go into our box set this week, then get along to sofpodcast.com, hit on the link for the weekend box set, and then you put your email address in the little box and sign up. And then you will get the email newsletter in your inbox Friday lunchtime, telling you the seven games you should be watching from Friday to Sunday. And we do restrict it to seven, even if it's a ridiculous weekend like the one we just had. We think, no, that's the limit of your football. Well, that's the limit of the reviews we're going to give. You can add your own football onto that afterwards. But that's all we have time for this week. It's been a bit of a discussion this week, hasn't it? Without Jan, you and I talking about the political machinations of FIFA.
This always happens when Jan goes away.
I know.
We end up disappearing up our asses, coming up with ideas about how we think that the world is going to be mapped out and stuff like that. And it's almost always wrong.
Yeah. The last thing we talk about is football when he's not around.
Yeah, it's never good when Jan is not here. But we hope that we have been able to provide you with some kind of diversion.
Yes, we do. As I said, that is all we have time for this week. So from me, Graham Sibley, and from Terry DeFello, it's goodbye.
Goodbye.
You can contact us through our website, sofpodcast.com, via Twitter, @SoundOfFootball, or on facebook.com/SoundOfFootball.
So, what are we going to talk about?
Well, I did think about this beard.
Beard?
This beard. The beard.
I thought you said beard.
I was thinking about this beard. What do you think? I think it's getting a bit Santa now.
What's that got to do with the podcast? All right. Okay. Yeah. So the bid. Yeah. Okay.